Our reading today is called Dying Into Now by Mark Nepo. Mark Nepo is a poet, author, spiritual leader, and cancer survivor. 3 years from my surgery, I am taking a shower, and there on my head along the scar is the beginning of a pimple. In 30 seconds, I am tripping into a cascade of what ifs. What if this is another tumor? What if it's spreading? As the water pelts me, my fear runs wild. I can see myself in the doctor's office, undressing for surgery, walking the halls in recovery, lying down for chemo, getting weaker, dying, there and back in 30 seconds. My heart is pounding, naked in the shower. I so want to live. I am so awake, finally at peace. But what if this is true? What shall I do? Where shall I go? But in this moment, the shower rinses me over and over, and I come home. If this is true, if I am to die soon, I know what I will do. I sigh more deeply than I ever thought possible. I will finish my shower. In that moment, I learned that everything is right where we are. No matter our pain or distress, all of life is in whatever moment we wake to. I could clearly see and feel how our fear of death makes us run, though there is nowhere to go. Yet mysteriously, I learned that there's a ring of peace at the center of every fear, if we can only get to it. Every time I shower now, I try to remember that we cannot live fully until we can first accept our eventual death. Otherwise, we will always be running to or running from. Only when we can accept that we are fragile guests on this earth, only then will we be at home wherever we are.
My father tells this story about a man who had this razor blade that he really liked. It was the blade part that they were discontinuing. He had the handle, but the blades were going to be discontinued. So he decided that he would just buy as many as he would need. You know, he would go out and buy however many of them he needed for the rest of his life. So he did some calculations, you know, actuarial tables and all that, how often he changed his blade. And he went out and bought, I don't know the number, but as many as he needed for the rest of his life, based on his best estimates. He put them in a container, kind of an open plastic container, and stored them under the bathroom sink. Things were going great. Whenever he'd use up a razor, he'd reach out and get another one. And then suddenly he realized that the number of razors in the container was marking the rest of the days of his life. And so he threw out all those razors and went and got a new one. The bracing fact of our own mortality. He faced that in the counting of the razors. I would have faced it in the calculating how long I had to live. For some time, I would think of death every night when I was lying in bed at bedtime. You know that time between after you turn out the light and before you go to sleep? I would have this awareness that I was going to die. And I didn't like it. It made me anxious. It made me uncomfortable. So I tried a variety of meditation techniques to put it out of my mind. And I had pretty good success with it. I have a lot of techniques. So I managed to stop that thought coming in that space between turning out the light and going to sleep. But I wonder if that's really what's best for me, putting that aside, not thinking about it. Perhaps not right before sleep. You want to relax into sleep. But I think it can be helpful to consider the reality of our own death. It can be helpful, perhaps, to even have a relationship with our own mortality. Since then, I have come to think of death as my bracing, challenging, yet helpful friend. What does it look like to be friends with death? I think of it as how you would make friends with any challenging person that you don't want to have anywhere in your life. Slowly, carefully, spending just a little time with your new friend until you can get more comfortable in their presence. And then eventually realizing that they're a companion who can teach you and remind you of what is important. My friend death teaches me that my time is short. Each spring, as I look at the blossoming trees, I wonder, how many more times will I see this? 20 more times? 30 more times? My friend death reminds me not to sweat the small stuff and reminds me to appreciate what I have. And he often suggests that gratitude is the perfect solution to all my difficulties. In the book, The Five Invitations, Frank Ostaseki tells us that death is not waiting for us at the end of a long road. Death is always with us in the marrow of every passing moment. She is the secret teacher hiding in plain sight. She helps us to discover what matters most. And the good news is we don't have to wait until the end of our lives to realize the wisdom she has to offer. One of our members, Cynthia Davis, is a hospice chaplain. She gave me some insight into her experience of how people relate to death. She tells me that when she has any new client enters their home for the first time, that the first challenge is helping them to acknowledge that they are indeed dying. Next, it's helping the family acknowledge that the person is dying. She calls this the elephant in the living room. She says that most people she works with have never had a conversation about death with anyone until, that is, she arrives. She asks the dying person, "What is important to you? What are your fears? What are your regrets? Who do you need to forgive?" These are powerful questions and an important conversation at the end of life, or perhaps any time. Why is it that we wait till the last moment to have an acquaintance with death? Well, because it's hard, because there's little support in doing it. Several years ago, our spiritual deepening circles had an exercise where we wrote our own obituary. And several people chose to opt out of that exercise. I don't know why they hesitated, and I don't need to know. I respect their choice. They know what is best for them. But I suggest that the exercise of writing your own obituary can be an important way to beginning your own internal conversation about end of life. How do you want to be remembered? What achievements and relationships are most important to you? What remains undone? Our culture does not support having a healthy relationship with death. It teaches us to do whatever you can to avoid accepting our mortality, even though death is all around us, on TV, in movies, in our newspapers, and let alone the almost now weekly shootings. Our culture sort of presents this idea that it goes like this: life, 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 death. Done, the end. I realize this is reflected in my own thinking about life and death. My dog Connor has a degenerative spine disorder, and he's slowly being paralyzed. At this point, he has limited use of the back. He can't use his back legs, and he has limited use of the front part of his body. So I realized that I was approaching the situation with this frame that he is dying, looking for the signs about when it might be time to end his life. But I realized he's very much alive. He loves eating, going on walks, playing ball, such as he's capable of doing. He's enjoying life. In fact, he's living and he's dying at the same time. And then I realized, so am I. Our bodies are degrading, but our cells are still multiplying. Our time is running out, but we are still creative and engaged beings. I'm a practitioner of earth-based spirituality, and there's a perspective in that tradition that death is very much a part of the cycle of life. These traditions, whether they're indigenous, ancient, or neo-pagan, honor the cycles of the earth and the seasons, the movement of the sun, the moon, and the planets, seeing humans in this greater context. Birth, growth, death, and rebirth are a cycle that forms the underlying order of the universe. With this foundational belief, it is easier to trust that death, like every phase of life, offers us opportunities for growth in wisdom and love. And that perspective helps me with my relationship with death. Unitarian Universalists don't have a shared theology about death or what happens to you after you die. Most of us believe that it is an unknown part of the great mystery. I want to welcome that mystery. I have faith that if I stay open to growth and stay connected to life, that as death comes closer, I will transition with comfort. Perhaps not physical comfort, but spiritual comfort. I have seen this many times as a minister. I have witnessed people on their deathbeds speaking of death with excitement, as if it's the next great adventure. One woman I remember well spent her last days curious about death. She was propped up in her bed so she could look out the windows and see the sky and the trees, and she exclaimed, "I hope there will be flowers." That's how I want my death to be. But it won't happen without effort. One author I read said that death and dying are the ultimate test of spiritual thickness. I want to believe they're the ultimate test of our interconnectedness, of our feeling part of the greater universe, of our having all the strands of the web coming into us and feeding out. We concern ourselves with taking care of our bodies to prolong our life and health, but we do less to prepare our spirits for death. At my end, I don't want to be running from fear of death. Like Mark Nepo, I want to find the center of my fear and make peace with it. As my life unfolds, I want to know that death is beside me, an honorable companion as much as my life. And on my deathbed, I want my spirit to be alive with excitement for the next great adventure. Blessed be.
I've been a hospital volunteer for over 30 years. I started in high school when the role was called candy striper and the uniforms were adorable. I'm sure you're not surprised. In college at UC Davis, I spent Friday nights at Sutter General Hospital in the emergency department, and then I served at Sutter Memorial Maternity and Cardiac. Many of you were born or had your own children at that site, now demolished. These days, I'm in the cardiac and neuro ICU downtown at Anderson Lucchetti. I've sat at over 100 bedsides with families as they make choices to withdraw life support or continue treatment, and I work to support what is generally called the death positive movement. Also, I'm a lawyer by training, and although I'm not here in that capacity, the law does deeply impact our current end-of-life practices. By virtue of our Constitution, we hold life, in the sense of being alive, as fundamental. Right at the top of our legal system, our stated right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's named worthy of protection by the state, our government. This document promises that the government shall pursue a right to life on behalf of us, its citizens. In its noblest form, our interest in supporting life relies on cultural values of justice and beneficence. To provide quality medical care even to the most disenfranchised or unable to pay. But in a more divisive way, it also underlines the Roe versus Wade debate. It wasn't until as recently as the 1970s and the Roe versus Wade debate that the United States started having the discussion about the legal right to choose what happens medically to your own body, when you could express it for yourself or when others needed to on your behalf. Prior to the 1970s, the government and courts took an active role in intervening to make choices to keep people alive, no matter their own interests. But it's not just our legal system that pushes towards medical intervention. The medical industry, and I don't use that word carelessly, is motivated towards treatment. Patients seek and doctors are trained to take some sort of action to restore imbalances of whatever sort. If there's something to be done, they usually do it. Insurance and medical billers have been paid for each service they provide. The more services, the more income. And then there's us. Mostly in the United States and other Western democracies, we conspire in our own ignorance, fear, and lack of control of the dying experience. We don't talk about dying, what it's like, what we want it to be like, what we're concerned about. And we should be concerned about the dying part. 85% of us say that we want to die at home, and 8% of us do. Medicare spends 25% of its total budget in a year on the 5% of people who die in that year. 40% of us over 85 will have clinical dementia. In California, 62% of nursing home residents run out of funds, and their care is provided by government funding through Medicaid. The estimated dollar value of long-term care provided by unpaid family caregivers was $470 billion. To the extent that death and dying has been hidden from us in this past century in a way it was not in the previous one, it has become more fearsome and more fraught. The decisions you and your advocates have to make these days about rounds of chemotherapy, feeding tubes, or multiple antibiotic-resistant viruses are much more complex. People are dying away from our view, even though they want to be at home, and costs are decimating financial security. Given this massive and consistent push from our culture to postpone death and our unsatisfying experiences around dying, I am here to encourage you to explore what you want out of your own dying experience, to talk about your goals with others, and maybe to even see your dying phase as creative, growthful, and a meaning-making part of our whole lives experience. Your end-of-life care choices have an impact on the larger community, most deeply the person chosen or assigned to be your advocate. Unplanned, uncommunicated crisis decisions can be deeply traumatizing to an advocate when the terminal person's goals are unclear and they still have to decide. Resistance to having conversations about your end-of-life experience with those you care about can cause your last moments to be chaotic, pain-filled, or narcotic vague, sacrificing an opportunity for meaningful connection, solitude, pleasure, closure, or wrapping up of practical affairs. I want to aggressively emphasized that if you want something aside from a full court press of treatments and interventions, you have to speak up strongly, publicly, consistently, and over time. Everyone should have an advance directive, but to achieve your goals, reduce chaos, and light the way for your advocates, much more than that is needed. I encourage you to approach the end of life with intentional information, with integrity and acceptance of the reality of what really is, with clarity about what trade-offs your values will direct, and with a willing and able team of support. Like a good life, there's no one right path to a good death. What most often turns out to be a good death is one in alignment with your own values, preferences, and characteristics. On a more fundamental level, a good death encompasses a kind of integrity to face the reality of what is and the autonomy to write your life story to the very end, including designing your legacy. We tend to approach our responses to terminal diagnosis or blatant physical failings in the way we have approached all the rest of our life. We have a style about how we think about the next chapter, whether it be a job loss or a new baby. Some find change an opportunity, others a challenge. Some of us approach change with a sense of humor, some with impeccable planning skills, some with faith. You will very likely approach the awareness of dying, of losing your independence, or your dignity, or your privacy, just about the same way that you've approached other unknowable situations so far. I'm here to encourage you to harness your style and your sense of meaning and put them to work for your dying, for yourself and for others you care about. Yes, we don't know how it will unfold or what scenario will take us down, but that's true of most things we do in life, and we plow ahead with moves to new towns, new jobs, with marriages, with energy that abides alongside uncertainty. When you learn and gather information, consider your preferences and your values and discuss them with your advocates, you can increase your control, reduce your anxiety about being swept away in arbitrary policies, and very likely achieve a situation that greatly reduces the chaos and gets you much more of the experience you want. Share with others your decision-making process so they can better support you and so they too can grow in their capacity to face this experience with integrity. In a more practical sense, here are a few things I've observed about a good dying. I encourage you to befriend your aging body, starting now, wherever you are. People are unkind to their bodies. You are not other than your body. Make friends with your sweet, vulnerable body. Take opportunities to be on the same team with it. Try not to frame dying as a war with your body. Do not set it up to result in failure, such as ideas of losing a battle with cancer, or hate parts of yourself, my bad knee, that are no longer flawless. Be generous and kind to your integrated whole. I'm not saying that the mind can heal the body, especially of terminal illness, but anger, resentment, failure, they're not the emotions to spend your last days in. They aggravate pain and they stand in the way of your resolutions, and you have a choice. For the most part, pain at the end of life can be well managed with morphine and anti-anxiety medications, but generally you exchange your pain relief for lucidity. Practice on the small pains you encounter now. Notice and nurture the ways you comfort, coach, and soothe yourself. Build your tolerance for being uncomfortable. This will give you more control over the time you have to do what matters to you. I practice sleeping on my back one night a week. Not being able to roll over is one of the most vociferous complaints of hospital patients. For me, it's a little bit uncomfortable and completely disruptive. I pay attention to how I soothe myself. Along with this, I would add, use this time to get comfortable with being touched by others. You will be subjected or treated, depending on how you frame it, to the caress of others. If you are at all squeamish about the physical care administered to you while dying, consider becoming more flexible there. Start with a pedicure or a podiatrist. Good walking leads to good living and good dying. Explore massage, facials, chiropractic, haircuts, the gym, and find ways to appreciate this physical form of caring for your own well-being. The concern I hear most from the dying is, I don't want to be a burden. It's hard for us to accept help. We don't even want to need it. We're founded on independence. For some of us, it defines our identity. But the truth be told, we all, anyone in relationship with any other person, is a burden. We have our failings. We laugh too loud or leave our clothes on the floor, forget birthdays or waste money. To be in a relationship is to be burdened and to be a burden, and yet have respect and tenderness despite it. In fact, for many, one of life's great joys and a source of deep meaning is what they are able to give to others. Nurturing children or students, sharing friendship, a comfort, a meal, cheering people on, or listening. Get better at having needs. Allow people to serve you. Practice feeling like a burden and finding ways to be gracious. Let the grocer carry your groceries to the car. Allow someone besides an Amazon drone deliver something to you, fix you a meal, go with you, sit with you. Come to a place where it's okay for you to receive resources. Allow people to support you in meaningful ways. Be clear and communicative about what you know brings you comfort, and be graceful about accepting such care. To receive care when you are helpless, unable to reciprocate, non-productive, or even undeserving is the ultimate gift of the human union. Many say that the state of unconditional dependence is the moment that our human form finally loses ego. Let's go of the experience of being a separated and independent force and can finally experience the interconnected web, the energy of something larger. Accept compassion, appreciate the pure energy of love that cares for the powerless. Celebrate your turn to experience the unconditional. Our yearning for autonomy and the ability to choose our path as we exit calls us to act with integrity to consider options for treatment as they really exist, to proclaim and model our values while we live, and to clearly communicate and listen to those in our circle of care about our goals. When we respond to the call, we design our legacy, get better care, and support those that care for us. May it be so.